Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Purdy Insurance. Visit Purdy Insurance on Market Street in Sunbury or visit online at purdyinsurance.com. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Steve Jones Show, News Radio 1070 WKOK. Sean Carey here, the Sunbury Motor Studio, Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai, North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia on the strip routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Steve and the family on a relaxing vacation, so that means this week we'll go back in time, replay some of the best conversations we've had here on the show. Look forward to that very much. Remember last fall we had Penn State and Pitt in Pittsburgh, and we dedicated a full hour to Penn State historian and the former executive director of the All Sports Museum at Beaver Stadium, Lou Prado. So we'll have a full hour with Steve and Lou next hour. Also coming up later this hour, we'll have a replay of an interview Steve had last fall with former Pittsburgh Steelers running back Merrill Hodge as he was bringing out his book on concussions and CTE. But we're looking forward to great replays throughout the week. Voice of the Patriots Radio Network, Bob Soci, tomorrow. Also, legendary Philadelphia sports writer Ray Didinger tomorrow. Replay that. And also, lots of great Penn State football conversation as we roll through the week, including former Penn State offensive lineman and a current lineman for the Tampa Bay Bucks, Donovan Smith. And we'll also replay from earlier this year, Penn State head football coach James Franklin during National Letter of Intent Day. Monday edition of the Steve Jones Show, always brought to you by Purdy Insurance on Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. Premium policies at the price that'll fit your budget and the people you want in your corner when life happens. So stop by Purdy Insurance, Market Street, Sunbury, or go to purdyinsurance.com. Also go to stevejonesshow.com. We have at least 3 months of previous shows there on the podcast archive page. And speaking of podcast, thanks to everybody that subscribed to our Steve Jones Show podcast. If you haven't done so yet, please do hit subscribe. After you search Steve Jones Show on iTunes, Apple Podcast app, Google Play, and then we drop the shows right to your smartphone and tablets. You can listen to them anytime, anywhere, and you can drop Steve a line anytime. Our email is stevejones@wkok.com. So even though this happened 3 days ago, this happened after we spoke with you on Friday afternoon, but it was just an amazing sight in sports. A Hollywood movie writer, if you're trying to come up with the the perfect script, this is what you'd come up with. Their first home game since their teammate Tyler Skaggs passed away, the Los Angeles Angels all wore number 45 to honor him last Friday night. And what'd they do? They went out and threw a combined no-hitter. Tyler's mom, Debbie Skaggs, threw out the first pitch. Bam! Right down the middle. You thought she was in the majors. Mike Trout hit a home run on the first pitch, traveled exactly 454 feet. That reads 45 in both directions. And the last combined no-hitter in the state of California was back on July 13th, 1991. That was the day Tyler Skaggs was born. Pretty amazing. Sports provides us an avenue to release all the bad stuff that goes in our lives. You know, sometimes we have to grieve. Well, sports can put a perspective on things, inspire us to do great things, play better, run faster, try harder. But boy, everything lined up for the Angels on Friday night. And you can't tell me otherwise. When Mike Trout stepped into that batter's box, come on, he thought of Tyler. Locked in, present in that moment. There's the pitch. Bam. And when Mike was circling those bases, he had to say to himself, hey, this one's for you. But that amazing scene with all the players wearing number 45, and they go out on the pitcher's mound and put all their jerseys on the mound in memory of Tyler Skaggs. I mean, it was just it's why we love sports. Love sports. And then that epic five-set classic at Wimbledon yesterday. between Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer. 13-12, fifth set. Just under 5 hours, longest final in Wimbledon history. And the Joker improving to 3-0 against Fed in Wimbledon finals. So Federer at 20, Rafa Nadal at 18, and Djokovic now at 16. And Djokovic said that was probably mentally the most demanding match I was ever a part of. Said the most physically demanding match was back in 2012. It was a match in the Australian Open against Rafa Nadal. But yesterday, mentally, a different level because of everything. So we've never seen anything quite like that, this era of men's tennis. And you just savor the moment, because who knows? We may never see those two players, Joker and Roger Federer, play in a Grand Slam final ever again. So search for that yesterday. If you don't watch a lot of tennis, but you want to see great drama unfold, rewind and watch that. So we talked about baseball a second ago. The baseball world will focus in on Cooperstown this weekend for the Hall of Fame induction ceremonies. And Montoursville's very own Mike Messina is part of the class of 2019. And right after the class of 2019 was announced earlier this year, Steve had a chance to speak with ESPN's Tim Kirkchin.
Well, my pleasure. I had a great time in Williams Point, and I hope to come back next year for that event, but I'll definitely be back in August for the Little League World Series and the Major League Classic.
Well, this Hall of Fame ends up with some local roots, and it's more than just Roy Halladay being with the Phillies. But obviously, Mike Messina, who's coaching basketball in his home, Montoursville. And the other part is that Braden Halladay signed his letter of intent to play baseball at Penn State in November. So there are a lot of local roots here. Your thoughts on those two men going in?
Well, Messina should have been in on the first ballot, in my opinion.
I agree.
I voted for him every year. He won 270 games with a .638 winning percentage. Like 10 pitchers in history have both of those numbers. Pitching his entire career in the American League East in a DH league during the height of the steroid era, and throw up those kind of numbers, especially in the postseason, to me warranted first ballot Hall of Fame induction. But he finally got in. Doesn't matter that it took this long, he finally made it, and very deservedly so. As for Roy Halladay, I'm thrilled that he got in the first year eligible again. Another guy with 200-plus wins, and in this case, a winning percentage of almost .660, which is ridiculously high. And his 10-year prime was, he was probably the best pitcher in baseball during that 10-year prime, and he was best at finishing what he started, which not many guys do today. He was a throwback on every level.
I remember when Penn State was getting ready to play Florida in the Outback Bowl. It was at the end of the 2010 season. It was the 2011 Outback Bowl, and Penn State was able to get an agreement with the Phillies to work out there. I remember sitting down with Joe Paterno to do the pregame show, and before we did it, he looked at me and says, "You wouldn't believe who was out there almost every day," and he was the only guy there. It was Roy Halladay, and he commented what an awesome guy he thought Halladay was. Does that tip us off as the kind of work ethic that Roy Halladay brought to the table, that in late December he's the one guy that's down there working?
Absolutely. I remember going to do a story on him one day at Camden Yards when the Blue Jays were in. I walked in the clubhouse at 3:30 in the afternoon. Greg Zahn was one of their catchers at the time, said, "Who are you looking for?" I said, "I'm looking for Roy." He goes, "I got here at 1:30, Zahn said, and he was in a pool of sweat when I got here. He said he's still working out. And he said, don't forget, he pitched last night." This is what Roy Halladay did every time he went out there, is he worked so hard so he could finish the game. He wasn't interested in striking everyone out. He was interested in pitching nine innings. So one day I was told by Brian Schneider, one of his former catchers, that he came off the mound after eight innings, and Charlie Manuel and Rich Doobie, the pitching coach, were there, hands extended, like, "Great job, Roy. We're going to let Brad Lidge pitch the ninth." Halliday, like, shimmied right past both guys, never even acknowledged they were there, didn't say a word, went and sat in his seat in between innings, and they looked at him and basically said to themselves, well, I'm not taking him out. And the other thought, well, I'm not taking him out. So Willie Halliday went out and pitched the ninth inning, because that's what he did. And that puts him in a different category than so many other pitchers in recent history.
When you look at the swing of Edgar Martinez, what did you see?
Well, I saw near perfection from the right side. Scott Bradley told me, Scott Bradley was one of his teammates and a really smart guy, now the baseball coach at Princeton, that Edgar's the best hitter he ever played with, better than Harold Baines, Mattingly, Ken Griffey Jr. Maybe not a better player, but a better hitter than those guys, because his swing was so perfect. He could get to that ball on the inside part of the plate better than almost any right-handed hitter you'll ever see. His hands and his forearms were so unbelievably strong. He was such a student of the game, and when Scott Bradley retired, he told me he asked the video coordinator with the Mariners to make him a tape of Edgar's beautiful swing and some of the highlights swings that he took. And then when he put it to the music of Kenny G's beautiful saxophone, so it's this beautiful sax music with this beautiful swing. And Scott told me years ago that he used to, you know, put that tape in for his baseball team in Princeton and just tell everyone, sit down and take 7 or 8 minutes and look at the best hitter I've ever played with. That's who Edgar Martinez was.
Yeah, I thought he was the right-handed swing to Will Clark's left-handed swing. I mean, it's like, wow, what a great swing.
He was really good, and only the people who actually played with and against him can appreciate what a difficult out he was in this era where there's so many walks, so many strikeouts, so many home runs. He had more walks than strikeouts in his career, and that is just unheard of today.
And then there's Mariano Rivera, the first 100%er. I'm still trying to figure out the nine that didn't vote for Hank Aaron, but that's all right. The first 100%er along the way. I mean, in an era where you have to throw all these different pitches, he did it with one pitch. When you look at Rivera, why was that one pitch so good?
Well, it had such late movement, and it had such incredible velocity when it was moving. Buck Showalter told me a story that they saw that his first year in pro ball. In fact, some guys would try to play catch with him, and they had trouble catching him because 10 feet before the ball actually arrived at the guy he was playing catch with, it just darted so quickly that people had trouble playing catch with Mariano Rivera, and he had that when he was 19 years old. So they just had to figure out, what are we going to do with this? Because he really didn't have another pitch. He didn't throw a curveball. He had a really stiff wrist, but he found a way, God-given way, to take that pitch and figure out what to do with it. And boy, did he ever, because he's the greatest closer of all time, and there is not even a close second.
And completely agree with that. Now, you released your ballot, and it was put on ESPN, so we know you voted for 10. And among the 10 you voted for were Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Gary Sheffield. What are your cases on each? Because obviously the debate will be, okay, but Tim, and they'll bring up the PED part of it. What is your counter to that?
Well, it's not an easy decision. I'm not comfortable doing it. I'm not even suggesting it's right. It's just the best I can do under the circumstances. It just seems to me that at the time that those guys played, specifically Bonds and Clemens, there was this tacit agreement going on in Major League Baseball that nobody's checking on this. There's no suspensions from this. No one's going to get caught. All sorts of guys are doing it. Guys on the other team are doing it. So it's not that I'm condoning anything here. It just seems to me that cheating has been a part of baseball for 140 years, and it was rampant at the time. And to punish two guys for doing it when all sorts of other guys were doing it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Now, if anyone doesn't vote for those guys, I totally understand. the other side to this issue, but I personally would feel like a hypocrite for not voting for somebody when I know what was going on, or now we all know what was going on at that time, and I'm just not going to punish somebody for doing something that seemingly a whole lot of other people were doing, and people weren't even checking on it back then.
Tim, there was a point, I think it was a game I was doing at Wisconsin with Jack Ham and Ira Miller, who's one of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and it's a different, you know, it's a different criteria, a different way of doing it, I understand. Came in and he said, "Hey Jack, let me ask you something." He said, "If Ray Guy's name comes up, a punter, who's a contemporary of yours, and Jack, hey, I'd vote for him in a heartbeat." So a specialist. Essentially, Mariano Rivera is a specialist, and you can claim maybe that the DH with Edgar Martinez is a specialist. Are we now seeing that line being blurred from specialist to everyday player or every rotation player?
Yeah, I think we're starting to differentiate a little bit here, and with Harold Baines going into the Hall of Fame and Frank Thomas a few years ago and David Ortiz on his way, I think we're looking at things a little differently now, and I've always looked at Edgar Martinez as a Hall of Famer, but I'm just not going to punish someone for taking advantage of a rule that was in the American League during his entire career. If there had been no DH, he was fully capable of playing third base or first base. He might not have been particularly good defensively, but we have a lot of subpar defensive players in the Hall of Fame because of the offense that he brought. So, yes, and with closers, you know, Trevor Hoffman's in. We've got Moore probably on the way. So I'm not going to agree that a closer is a punter, even though Ray Guy was unbelievably good. But I disagree with that, but I'm also not going to listen to people who say that the closer role is completely unimportant and the last three outs are like any other three outs of the game or not. And I think Mariano Rivera proved that, and I think he's going to do a lot to get other closers eventually into the Hall of Fame.
I completely agree. I mean, to me, if you're important to winning the game and you're the best at doing it, I mean, that's how I've always felt. We're in an era now with so many playoff games. I mean, Ted Williams played in 7 postseason games in his life in 1 World Series. Willie Mays never hit a postseason home run, for example. What is the postseason to you if you've got a couple of candidates really close? Is it a separator or not?
Well, it still is to me, within reason. To say Ted Williams wasn't a good postseason player, it's ridiculous. He didn't have enough of an opportunity to do that.
Right, that's my point.
Willie Mays. With all of these games that we play today, I'm going to put increased emphasis on greatness in the postseason. And yet, I also totally understand that when Bernie Williams and Mickey Mantle have the same number of career homers in the postseason, and I believe it's fairly close, there's just no way that Bernie Williams was as good a player postseason or regular season as Mickey Mantle. And I love Bernie Williams. That's not the point. The point is you have to factor in how many games these guys get to play in the postseason today compared to Mickey Mantle's time when you won the pennant, you played 4 games and the postseason was over. That's how it works sometimes, especially with the Yankees. So all sorts of factors go into that, but yes, I am still, if I see a guy who's great in October and the rest of the numbers are good, I'm going to give him some extra credit points for doing it when it matters the most.
Right, and that's exactly my point about postseason back then to now. Williams never got a chance. Mays barely got a chance. Now we have so many of them, I think it gives us a better sample size.
Yes, absolutely. And again, this is also not like basketball where LeBron James touches the ball on every possession and therefore affects every game way more than a center fielder can, who might get 4 at bats and not even catch a fly ball. So let's understand that just because you don't win the World Series as a baseball player, I'm not sure you should be punished for that, because it's such a team sport and there's only so much that one player can do.
Yeah, look, people don't realize how fragile winning is sometimes, I swear. Thanks so much, Tim. I appreciate your time. It's a lot of fun talking about this. It's always great to have you on. And again, the people up in Lycoming County loved having you up there earlier.
Well, thank you, Steve. I'll talk to you soon, and I'll see you soon, hopefully.
I hope to see you soon, too, Tim. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
We look forward to seeing Tim Kirkchin back in Williamsport next month for the Little League World Series and the Little League Classic at Bowman Field, which this year will be the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Chicago Cubs. Best of Steve Jones Show continues next half hour. Pittsburgh Steelers former running back Merrill Hodge about his book Concussions as we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Purdy Insurance.
Your summer just got better with the summer sales event at Sunbury Motors Kia. Summer is heating up as the prices cool down. During the Kia Summer Sales Event, you can drive away in that brand new Kia for less than ever. Lease a 2019 Kia Niro LX for only $289 a month.
Only $289 a month.
A 2019 Kia Forte LXS for just $239 a month.
$239 a month.
And a 2019 Kia Optima LX for only $269 a month.
$269 a month.
And all Kias come with a 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty. The deals are heating up during the summer sales event at Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf.
Lease term is 36 months, 12,000 miles per year, $1,200 total due at signing or equivalent trade. No security deposit required, tax and tags extra. Offer expires 7/30/19. Warranty is a limited powertrain warranty. For details, see retailer or go to kia.com.
For nearly 100 years, Purdy Insurance has been your locally owned, family-operated source for insurance products. With a staff of over 20 and partnerships with some of the industry's most trusted companies, Purdy has the experience and resources to get the job done. Whether you need personal, home, and auto, or complex business insurance solutions, Purdy will help you navigate through the process. Call today at 570-286-5855. Or better yet, stop in their Sunbury office to see what Purdy Insurance can do for you.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai North 4th Street Auto Plaza Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia on the Strip, routes 11 and 15 Hummel's Wharf. And the Steve Jones Show today brought to you by Purdy Insurance, Market Street, Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. The products and policies you trust and the people you want in your corner when life happens. PurdyInsurance.com and visit them too on Market Street in Sunbury. Steve on vacation this week. I'm Sean Carey, so we're going to go back in time and enjoy some of the best interviews from shows gone by, including last October when former Pittsburgh Steelers running back Merrill Hodge joined us.
Good talking to you, Steve. Happy to be on there, buddy.
All right. All right. So, look, there are certain assumptions that are made, and once a narrative is established, it is very difficult to buck the narrative. Do you consider that a fair statement? And if so, how does it apply to the argument on CTE?
You mean the narrative that's already been established?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt. And that's one of the real issues with this particular subject. You know, just to share you a quick story and making this real quick, I've done a lot of media. I've had literally people from the media call me and start right off the bat and say, I cannot believe you don't believe in CTE. How can you tell me concussions don't cause CTE? And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Have you read the book? No. I'm like, well, no.
Right.
I know how you call. I'm called to discuss the book because all those questions are answered in the book. So let me start with how this book came about. I really came from a parent perspective. Regardless of all the things I've done, I'm a parent. My son started playing at age 7. He's a quarterback at BYU. Just had surgery today on his toe. I've seen the headlines. I was like, okay, what is it? And I have a life philosophy to find a way. Actually, I wrote a book on that, and it's always give me action, inspired action to do something about it, find answers, find the people. Well, I went across the country, even into Canada. I met with neuropathologist after neuropathologist. I cut brains with them. I sat there. I did it myself. I asked questions, and I asked that one question, what is CTE? Universally, this is exactly what they would say to me. They say, Merrill, CTE is a pattern in an observation state. We don't know what causes it, and we don't know what causes it causes. We have cases where they played football and had concussions. We have cases where they played sports and had no concussions. And we have cases where they never played football, they never played sports, and they have no history of head trauma. And I'm like, well, why do we only hear about the football ones then? They would say this, the experts, the neuropathologists, exactly right. The science community is disturbed that it has gotten this far. We shake our heads. We are observing this. We have no idea. And I was like, then there's a litany of things from that, how the narrative has gone so far. You just use the media. For example, they talk, just I told you the stories. They call me up and they tell me for fact. In fact, one guy was going to send me the science papers, believe it or not, to prove he was right, that concussions cause CTE. I said, just so you know, you're the only guy in the history of this planet that has that science, so you know. So please send it. I'm looking forward to reading those papers. I've read all the papers. I've had them explained to me. Now, to his credit, he calls me, emailed me back a day later. He said, I'm sorry, I'm wrong. But for years, this guy has been printing that and saying that.
Right.
And that's why the book became so important, because we explained the steps of science, standards of science, how incomplete the science work is at this time, the true definition of where they are versus what you see in the media. But then all of the good things that are going on in sports, the things that if parents knew about, how exciting it was, from protocols to treatments and therapies, if your son or daughter had a concussion. And it's not just in his athletic arena. I tell people all the time, my son had his first concussion his freshman year, 4 days before their first bowl game. He slipped in the shower. So it can happen anywhere in any environment. So wouldn't it be better to know how to handle head trauma, the treatments and therapies that are there for it, and the real truth of the science? Now, you do with what you want, but at least I've done a lot of the work to help you understand it, and it'll help empower you. And then you use the information, what works best for you, your family, your choices, and how you want to use it for activities.
I mean, I'll give you one that is a fact, and I've used it on the show a couple of times. There are actually, quote, more head injuries playing soccer than there are playing football. Yet football is always the focal point of this. And how much does that bother you that football is always the focal point?
Well, another reason I wrote the book, because we actually break that down too and explain all of the concussions in all of the activities, not even in sports. I mean, just all activities, trampoline. Sure. We could start going on and on with stuff. I just got off a call today, and this guy probably put it best. He was a reporter. He's done a lot of research on the rehab centers across this country with concussions, across the country, okay? He said, he's asked everybody, if football were to be abolished today, no football at any level, he's like, what would that do to your concussion clinic? All of them said, a majority of their, basically said, it would affect us, it would only affect us 10%. Meaning, it's only 10% of their work is from football.
Yeah. Football.
The other 90% is from all other activities and other sports. Wheeled sports, bicycles, roller coasters, I mean, the trampolines, basketball, soccer, lacrosse. I mean, the whole litany of other sports. But I was like, wow, 10%. Even that kind of, I was like, wow. He goes, it would not affect us at all. He goes, there's 10% of what we see is football related from head trauma.
You did a lot of research on this. Not a little. I mean, a lot. I mean, I'm sitting there, I'm reading this, and I'm going through this book, right? And Jack Hamm, by the way, is going to borrow the book for me, too. So it's that. I'm interested to see what Jack says when he's done reading it. But when I look at it, the Boston University work has essentially, and if I'm using the wrong word here, let me know, it seems like the BU work has been considered gospel on this. Has it been tough to break through gospel when talking to people because of the BU studies are given such credence?
Well, first of all, you're right. And it's always tough to break through something like that unless you have the one thing that matters. You have the truth. And you have the power of that. You have the scientific evidence of that. The one thing I think people need to understand, like, the science papers out there, everybody uses. You know, it isn't like, you know, Dr. Cummings and I have our own science papers, and it's our science papers against BU science papers. No, it's all the papers. Mayo Clinic, Vanderbilt, I mean, not just BU's that nobody gets to see. There's voices out there screaming, slow down. This has gone out of control, but nobody wants to hear those. Nobody listened to them. That's why I wrote the book, too. I put it all in there. I got a website, brainwashbook.com. The science papers are there. So it isn't like I'm saying, hey, take my word for it. I want you to educate yourself and empower yourself. Read the papers. Read some of read the disclaimers on them, or the conclusions at the end. There's literally these words in there: caution, you can't use this to gauge disease of any kind. Okay, I'm kind of paraphrasing there, but the caution word is in there. That you can't use this is in there. And you can't use this to measure level of disease, like in age of exposure. That's literally in the papers. And then the same people who write the player or write the paper are in the media, and they contradict what they wrote in the science paper. And it's just like, that stuff was just so disturbing to me. It's abuse of the Hippocratic Oath they signed, quite honestly, that you wrote the paper, you know that you got bullet holes all over the place. You even wrote the word caution, I can't use this, and then you present it as fact. And that's where we've gone wrong. That's why we wrote the book. And we do that, too. We help you understand that in there, the difference between what you've seen in the media versus what really is in the science work.
I mean, you and I are both big believers in what football can do for you, attitude-wise, discipline-wise, athletically. There's a long list of reasons why football is really good. You have invested a lot of time in youth football. Merrill, what are the importances of teaching the game right? And in your experience, what's a good time to then you start thinking about allowing young people to have contact playing the game in terms of, okay, instead of flag football, now you're going to have contact playing it?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I'm going to use my own experience and how I did it. I'm not going to ever tell anybody how to do it, because I don't think anybody should do that on both sides of the fence. Kids, if you're going to let your kid play tackle football, nobody should question that. And if they do, they're uninformed and ignorant and don't want to know the facts. The science, there's no scientific evidence that playing contact football at a young age from 7 to 11 has harmed any child later in life. There's no scientific evidence of that. And the papers are in there, actually, in the website and the book, and we talk about that. Now, that being said, that's what we're doing today, and actually has gotten misunderstood. We've created so many options in football, from tackle, flex, flag, 7-on-7. We've done this for a reason, to help. Each kid might have a different entry level. I've coached youth football for a long time. Been coaching camp since 1991. Started coaching my son in 2003 as a youth football coach. Is there a couple of kids that I go back and look at? Hey, they could have started with flag for a couple of years and then went into tackle. And then there's a majority. My son would be that one of those kids. He just wanted to play tackle. He was meant to play tackle football, and he started at age 7. And I'm like, I start thinking, to have robbed my son of that opportunity, the things that he's learned that I've been able to teach young kids. Listen, I have a coaching philosophy. We coach our kids in the yardsticks of their years and not ours. I tell my coach that right off the bat. Here's what it's going to give you: patience and perspective. Okay, we're 38. Okay, they're 8. Let's not forget that. Okay, when we tell them something and they forget it 2 seconds later, they're 8. They're not 38. They're going to do that. When they go home and they're worried about playing and pizza and having a good time, they come back and they've forgotten everything we talked about. They're 8. And if we teach like that, A, it helps us. But the things we get to teach from it, the life lessons, you know, people talk about, you know,
right.
When you don't quit in life, how do you teach that? What environment do you ever have? I mean, sports is a great environment for that. Let me just say this. On this quest, had I found out otherwise with this disease, with the pattern of CTE, what they see from the scientists and the neuropathologists across this country and in Canada, had I thought for 1 second my son was in jeopardy, my son wouldn't be playing football.
Same here.
I am not. And I was not. Somebody asked me this the other day, and I thought it was a fabulous question. I never really thought about it. They said, when you started this, did you expect it to end like this? And I was like, you know, I didn't know what to expect, which is kind of interesting. I didn't. I just wanted to know the truth. Was I shocked that the science world is saying, I mean, are you kidding me? We are observing. We have no idea what causes it. But we have cases outside of sports, and more are showing up across the UK, in Australia, and the United States itself, and in Canada. All of these cases where nobody's even part of sports, never played football, never had a concussion. I've had neuropathologists go, you know, we're looking in the wrong place, you know, and really this could be nothing. But I'm like, we don't know. And I keep going back to, when you don't know, you don't know. So why can you say anything more than that? You just don't know.
Well, and part of it is you don't know because it can't properly be diagnosed until after death. Dave Duerson, Junior Seau. For goodness sakes, I mean, I've known Larry Johnson because Larry Johnson went to State High here, and then I announced his games here at Penn State. He's assuming he has it, or at least the symptoms of it, and that's you can't tell at this stage.
Well, see, there's a bunch of harmful things said right there. I mean, Larry Johnson, I think he's already diagnosed with bipolar or something. Now, for him to self-diagnose himself and talk about symptoms, I'm going to go back to what they said. They don't know what causes it, and they don't know what it causes. So nobody knows that there's any symptoms from this, and nobody knows what those would be. Okay, so we can't even let see people speculate that, but we do. We put them on Good Morning America, and we run that title on there. Well, what are people going to think? You got people self-diagnose themselves. Here's what a neuropathologist said to one time when I said, I asked him specific questions about stuff like that. She looked at me, she said, let me tell you something. Alzheimer's, we've been working on for decades. Hundreds and hundreds of doctors are working on it and collaborating on it. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of papers have been written on it, clinics done on it. Thousands of brains have been looked at, and we don't know what causes that. How are you going to tell me one paper and one research thing is given give you any answers? She looked at me, she goes, it's a pinprick as far as starting. And I was just like, wow. I mean, I'm like, but then that's really what kind of really disturbed me. It's like, you know, people are running around scared to death, and the mom or the dad that don't know, haven't lived where I've lived, know what I know. I mean, I don't blame them if we're seeing stuff in the headlines and say, my kid's not going to play. And I'm scared to death. I love my kids without end. I'm all in line with that. That's why I was so passionate about writing this book. I couldn't write it fast enough, but it is studious. It takes so much time. And to finally get it out, to have the information that I was taking years to figure out and put together to help people with that decision, I'm proud of that. I'm happy about that. And I'm happy for all the doctors that helped me because I couldn't have done it without them.
Yeah, you should be. And I lost my father to Alzheimer's, so everything you just said was gospel about it. I mean, nobody knows, and millions have been invested in it. You learned a lot in doing this. Okay, how important was it for you to absorb the information and not have preconceived thoughts about it and then have the information form your thought?
Well, I think that was vital at the very beginning. You know, listen, there's nothing I can do about my career. My career is over, you know.
Right.
And I was thinking about, you know, my son. I was like, well, shoot, man. I mean, I'm not, he's not really at age I can tell him to quit playing. You know, he's not a kid anymore. But I've always thought, and here's what I think we need to get at, especially if you're somebody, regardless of what you heard right now, there'll still be people going, he doesn't believe in CT, even though I've already told you what it is. I haven't even explained what it is. And they go, he doesn't believe concussions cause CT. Again, there's no scientific evidence of that. I've asked doctors. I've had them explain papers to me. Going in with an open mind with, listen, I just want to know the truth. I'm telling you, that cleared me of everything. I was just like, let it come to me. Just let me. I didn't use just Dr. Cummings. I mean, he's a brilliant dude. However, I mean, from Julian Bell's, Lizzie Hazarati up in Canada, I mean, and literally cutting brains and look and listening and watching, and everybody kind of starts repeating the same thing. I'm like, okay, this is not an accident. You know, people don't even know I talk to, say, Lily. Nobody knows I talk to Peter. You know, these are people, neuropathologists, just sharing what the real truth is to me. And that just gave me real comfort, too, that I knew I was on the right path. Then the science papers, like I said, everybody's using the same science papers. How people interpret them the way they do in the media is really evil and wrong. But that's why I put them on the website. Read them. Go through them. Read all the stuff in there. And then you just take the information and use it how you want to. But I've always thought it's best to have all the information to help us make choices versus, you know, something out of fear that you see in a headline.
Yeah, finally, because I know I have to let you go, but Dr. Margaret Patukian, who's at Princeton now, had been one of the team doctors here at Penn State, and she was our team doctor for basketball. So 25 years ago, she'd be talking about concussions and the susceptibility to another one. So she and others have done a great job of just advancing to making sure that there's more knowledge and everyone's more intelligent about it, which goes back to one of the stories you tell in the book about you missing the last preseason game. The Bears are going to play the Buccaneers to open the season. You have a splitting headache. And on the phone, the general practitioner says, "How are you feeling?" "I'm fine." "Okay, you're cleared."
Yeah. See, that, you know, what you're talking about is a protocol. And you got to realize the Steelers are doing cognitive testing in 1991. Okay?
Yep.
That's before anybody in the professional world, actually in the neuropathology world in this country, knew anything about another tool for head trauma. Just, that's a real honest perspective people have to remember, okay? Nobody knew about it. Nobody in professional sports. The Steelers, even though they were doing it, because Chuck Noll challenges Joe Maroon and then Dr. Lovell gets involved, they don't even really know why they're doing it other than to please Chuck Noll to create a subjective and objective information when somebody had a concussion. So think of that in 1991, but now where we are today, the protocols and treatments and therapies. That's why protocol that we have available now should be everywhere in all sports, and it needs to be applicable, okay?
Yep.
Just because we have it doesn't mean people are doing it. That's the thing that's most important. That's why I went to Congress in 2009 and pleaded for them. We're doing nothing for 99% of the football players. I was specific to football when I was there. Which is 8 to 18. Okay, we're doing stuff for the NCAA and the NFL. 99% of our players are 8 to 18. Let's establish a protocol now. And that protocol was any type of sign of head trauma, they got removed and they could not return to whatever event they were a part of. And then they couldn't play the next week. So it gave them a 2-week window to help the brain, because we knew that even though you might still start feeling better, you still, the best chance of you returning was a 2-week window. That's where neuropathologists felt it was best. Now keep in mind, that's 2009 too. That's almost a decade later. The treatments and therapies that are available, the improved protocols, I mean, this is the safest environment we've ever had in the history of sports.
Yes.
If you picked an era, you wouldn't want to play in the era where you had a strap in your helmet and you didn't drink water, or you're considered soft and you did nothing for head trauma. You'd want to play now.
Yes.
And unfortunately, that message has gotten lost, and hopefully the book will give you the information to at least let you know how to handle head trauma if it ever happens, and know the treatments and therapies. And keep in mind, Western Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, some of the best resources in the country, although there's good ones all over the place. I'm sure that up in Penn State area, you guys have them too. And we need the parents to know about those so they can get their kids help if they do have a concussion and they're having symptoms afterwards.
I thought this was fascinating. I couldn't put it down. It was really well researched, and it is an important read. I hope you don't mind me saying that. It was an important read. Thank you so much for A, writing it, and B, for being on the show to talk about it.
My pleasure, brother. Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury. You can hear us anywhere in the world with the Sunbury Broadcasting Corporation app.